dead. The original company that published this book was called the Works Publishing Company for that reason. Okay, and he said, for how appallingly true for the alcoholic, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, thank you, through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And wherever you see people that tell me, I worked the steps years ago, I know that this person is in grave danger, because the steps are not something that you worked years ago. The steps are something that you are working now, or you're dieting, and if you're dieting, you're on the road to eating. So we're going to work on that this afternoon. Fail to enlarge or perfect. Okay. Then faith would... Okay, if he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die, then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. My wife and I abandon ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate, for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going. Lois Wilson changed the history of the world when Bill was out of the hospital and he's dragging these guys off bar stools, trying to sober them up, bringing them home. Lois is cooking for them and they're living in their house. And finally, one day, Bill comes in and he says, "Damn it, Lois, this doesn't work. I thought it was going to work. It doesn't work. Nobody's getting sober." And she changed the history of the world when she turned to him and said, "But you're staying sober." It hit him like a truck. Wait a minute. This is the first time in my life I'm able to stay sober. There is something to this working with other people. So he goes back to the town's hospital and he says to Silkworth, "What am I doing wrong?" And Silkworth says, "I've heard about some of these shenanigans you're pulling out there, Bill, trying to sober up these drunks, and I admire your hard work and enthusiasm. But stop trying to preach at these drunks from some spiritual hilltop. Tell them what I told you of the illness. Tell them of the hopeless condition of mind and body. Tell them about the allergy. Tell them about the mental twist, as I told you." And just shortly after that conversation with Silkworth, he found himself in Akron, Ohio, in a proxy battle for a machine shop and a rubber factory over there in Akron, Ohio. And he knew that Saturday night that he needed to work with another alcoholic. It was May of 1934, and the very first person that he got to try out his new method of bringing the message to was Bob Smith, that he met through a call to Reverend Tunks. Reverend Tunks hooked him up with Henrietta Cyberling. Henrietta Cyberling hooked him up with Ann Smith. Ann Smith hooked him up with Dr. Bob. Is it odd, or is it God, that these things came together to bring about the greatest movement and the greatest fellowship and the greatest way of life? And I'm alive today, and dare I say some of you are alive today, because of all these various things that came together. Let's finish the chapter and then we'll be done for the morning. We can open for sharing or questions or whatever. But help. We commenced. Okay, now remember we were talking about how he had these fast friends and they went away and became a lone wolf. Here's some more promises. We commenced to make many fast friends and a fellowship has grown up among us, which is a wonderful thing to feel a part. The joy of living we have even under pressure and difficulty. I have seen hundreds of families set on their feet in the path that really goes somewhere. Have seen the most impossible domestic situations righted. Feuds of bitterness and of all sorts wiped out. I have seen men come out of asylums and resume a vital place in the lives of their families and communities. Business and professional men have regained their standing. There is scarcely any form of trouble and misery which is
not been overcome among us. In one Western city and its environs, there are 1,000 of us and our families. We meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, one may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in numbers and power. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seemingly worldliness and levity. But just underneath, there is deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it right with us right here and now. Each day, my friend, simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill toward men. And we see how it comes together. And we see how very human people had very, very spiritual experiences and awakenings, and we see the hand of God all over the place. That this is not something that somebody cooked up in a laboratory. This is not something that just happened. That there are evidences of a higher power all over our history. And in the 1950s, a man by the name of Jim W., realized that people with a gambling addiction needed a place to go, and he was an alcoholic, but he realized that there were many gamblers who were not alcoholics, and they needed a place to go and identify too. And he started an organization in Oxnard, California called Gamblers Anonymous. We talked about GA being Gluttons Anonymous, but he started GA as Gamblers Anonymous. And in 1958, Roseanne S. took a friend of her husband's, and they went to a meeting of Gamblers Anonymous because he had a severe gambling problem. And she heard in the Gamblers Anonymous meeting in California, in Los Angeles, in 1958, all manner of things which she could relate to as a compulsive overeater. And she, our founder, went up to Jim Willis, their founder, and said something that changed the world. She said, "Jim, do you think a program like yours could help people like me?" And he turned to her and changed the course of the world when he said, "You know, Roseanne, I don't see why not." In 1960, on the 19th of January in Los Angeles, California, the very first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous occurred. And the rest is history, and here we are. So we're done for this morning. We have until noon. I hope that some of the history is not just entertaining, but if there's anything about the history that I find fascinating, it's fascinating, it is that the hand of Almighty God is all over the place. And in Tempe, Arizona, and in Luling, Texas, where independence starts of people trying to stop eating compulsively. And in Luling, Texas, there was a guy by the name of A.G. Ainsworth. And A.G. Ainsworth was a great guy. He became our first man in OA, not because he did anything special, but before then it was forbidden for men to attend the meetings. And he, along with a person named Norma B., started Gluttons Anonymous. But before they did, A.G. went on a church retreat, and he had a friend, John B., who was an alcoholic, and A.G. was a compulsive overeater. And he said to his friend John B., and tried to make it sound like he was joking, but the seriousness was there, and he said to John B., "Do you think a program like yours would help someone like me?" And John said, listen to the words, "You know, A.G., I don't see why not." And the rest is history. Is it odd or is it God? I'll shut up now until after lunch.
I got to meet A.J., and AG, he was instrumental in starting the first silent retreat that we had.
Yes.
In OA, and so in Abilene, we had our first OA retreat with AJ, AG. And it was really, really, really awesome.
He was a big believer in silent retreats. That was a huge thing, and he had been on them as a boy in church camp, and as a he went on Alcoholics Anonymous ones too. He was a huge believer in silent retreats. One thing I'm not known for is silent retreats.
I love
him too. God rest his soul. He left a lot of money to OA, but he also left a legacy which will never be duplicated. He was our first business person. He was a bunch of housewives, and in comes this great big Texan, and he comes in there, and he organized, along with a guy by the name of Sandy B, who was an attorney, who was one of us, and Sandy organized our first bylaws and registered us with the IRS as a nonprofit organization, and they laid the groundwork for everything that our World Service conventions and World Service business conferences do even today. That groundwork was laid out by A.G. Ainsworth and by the early people. Sandy B. was our attorney and so on, but A.G. was very instrumental, and he had very thick Texas drawl. He later he lived in a place called Luling, and then he went to a place called Gonzales, Texas, and then later in life he moved over the border into Mexico. But he was quite a guy. He told me in an elevator in Baltimore to keep carrying your message, and I said, should I tell people about my weight loss? And he said, yes. He says, how in the hell are they going to know it works if you don't tell them? You must tell people how long you've been abstinent and how much weight you've lost. Otherwise, they won't know it works. And he encouraged me to do a lot of good things, and he was great. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Janice, compulsive overeater, and going through Bill's story. So one of the things that occurred to me that had not occurred to me before, and I've been reading it a lot lately, it was a sponsorship assignment. Was the talking about him being in law and then deciding that wasn't for him. And I was thinking, you know, all the rules and the reading and but the speculating, you know, there's this a lot more possibility for luck to be involved. And I may not have to work so hard, but I could make that work for me. But, oh, that would appeal to me. And the other thing was in looking at, you know, that he was so undernourished, 40 pounds underweight. Which, of course, when we read this as overeaters, it's like, well, that sounds like a bargain. Maybe I'll drink. But when I think about how unhealthy I was, packing my body full of the junk that I did, and it was starving for real food, for real nutrition. And while I was, you know, while I was overweight, I was still so sick, and I feel so much better and so much healthier today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Janice.
Thanks, Janice.
You mentioned something that recovery can't begin until you stop eating.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you mean by stop eating?
Compulsively and eating your allergic foods. And maybe those allergic foods will change over time when more is revealed to you. But at some point, I have to put down the damn food. And I have to stop waiting till I want to. I have to stop waiting to work the perfect food plan. I have to stop waiting for the world to line up as I want it to. And there's four things that compulsive overeaters and alcoholics, Al-Anons, gamblers, there's four things we do. We lie, we assign blame, we keep scoring, we fight battles that just don't exist. And one of the battles that we like to fight that doesn't really exist is, I'll give up the food when, I'll give up the food if, I'll give up the food at some point. Put it down now. Start from where you are. It's not going to be the food plan you're going to be on in a year or two, depending on what your situation is. Put it down. Stop. If you're bulimic, stop the purging now. If you're anorexic or you're bulimic, well, the bottom line is at some point I have to plug the jug. If you go to an AA meeting, and I'm not an alcoholic, I'm one of the guys you'll meet in OA, I am not an alcoholic, didn't come in through AA. They have to plug the jug. At some point they have to stop, and that's what we mean by that.
Could you say those four things again?
There's four. This is not reconcilable in the big book, so this is just what I'm telling you. There are four things that alcoholics, addicts, compulsive overeaters do incessantly We lie to ourselves and others. We assign blame. We keep score in our relationships, and we fight battles that just don't exist. We're out there on the battlefield, and we're riding our steed, and we've got our shield and our sword, and we're swinging that sword, and there's nobody for 1,000 miles. We are just out there, and you know, we're going to fight that battle yet another day. No way I'm talking to that witch. No way I'm making amends to that guy. No way I'm doing this. Let it go. Oh my God in heaven. We were just talking about, somebody was telling me how their relative, they were a country western DJ, and all, they were using the name Hatfield and McCoy. And, you know, we were all, maybe not all, but we were seeing that show that they had on the other night about it, all those people that died in the feud between the Hatfields and McCoys. What a waste. Oh my God. And it's so easy to see that and laugh at it and think, what a dumb waste. I did do the same thing. Oh my God, there was casualties all over my life. Decades of my life were wasted fighting battles that just don't exist. They don't exist. You and I went as children to the Chicago Historical Society on Clark Street, right? Okay? Okay, anybody else from Chicago? One other person. Where are you from?
Well, Park Ridge, Indiana.
Where?
I lived in Northwest Indiana. I lived in Park Ridge.
Park Ridge is, as far as I'm concerned, I lived on Devon Avenue, so Park Ridge and I are old friends. That's fine. And you have to go through there to get to Lockwood Castle, which is good, because I have to get the ice cream over there on Central Street. They're out of business. See, I moved out of Chicago. They're out of business. Okay. Who else? I saw another hand here. Who else was from Chicago? Somebody else raised another
hand. My mother's best friend lived in Chicago, Elk Grove Village.
Okay, Elk Grove Village.
All right. Time in Chicago.
All right, I like Elk Grove Village. Yeah, it used to be like we were talking Palatine way out there. Now it's not. Now it's like part of my backyard. Okay, anyway, what was I talking about? Oh, Chicago Historical Society. And if you go to the Chicago Historical Society, the part of the world or the history that Chicago is most linked to, obviously, is the Civil War. The Civil War, Grant was from Illinois, Lincoln was elected out of Illinois, and so there's a ton of Illinois contact, a ton of Illinois history going in there. Now, one of the things that I noticed at the Chicago Historical Society is there was a battle outside New Orleans, Louisiana, at the very end of April, April the 30th, 1865. 96 people were killed and about 115 were wounded. I don't know why I remember that. I just do. I don't know why. Now, why is that idiotic? Why is that insane? The war ended on April the 14th and 15th, 1865. Lee gave his sword to Grant at Appomattox Courthouse 2 weeks before that battle occurred. Those people died for nothing. They used to pull these guys out of the Japanese tunnels. As late as the 1960s, they'd find these Japanese soldiers that wouldn't leave their post. And these guys had been in those tunnels since the 40s. And they'd find these guys out in Guam or the Philippines or some Manila or Philippines or whatever the hell. And they'd find these guys, my God in heaven, these poor guys were out there fighting a battle that was over. Oh my God, by the 1960s, Japan was as Americanized as Texas or Kansas, for God's sake, you know, in terms of manufacturing and things. And these guys are in there and they're going to fight battles that just don't exist. Don't exist! You can laugh at that. But is my life any different? Is your life any different? Nope. Not if you're one of us, it's not. And we lie incessantly. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I'll shut up.
No, I was just going to say, those battles that you're referring to, you're talking of our mind, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Fighting the battles in our mind against this one. I don't mean really going out there. I hope not. I mean, you'll get arrested for that. But fighting these battles in your mind.
The imaginary dialogue that we have on the compulsion, the obsession.
Dialogue against people and places and things.
And the bizarreness that we... Like if you have the battle, then your response is as if those things were true. So if I thought my husband didn't want to have sex with me because I was unattractive or unappealing, then I would be angry with him.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing he ever said, nothing that was ever real, but because of my thoughts about what he felt, I then reacted to him as if he had said those things to me with an anger and a resentment and a shame and a blah, 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 that went on and on and on. So the other thing I wanted to ask, we were supposed to put down the food, plug it, and I totally get that. I just recently have done this, and it'll be 2.5 weeks ago.
Excellent.
And I'm thinking clearer than I've ever thought in my mind, because I would use things. I may not have binged per se. I'm one of the few people in here that doesn't eat sugar. I don't like it. But boy, you give me a good cream sauce and a good butter, I'll eat the world. But those things, and my life is so intertwined with relationships and food. My sponsor made a great analogy that all my relationships are food, children, family, everything. I serve millions, I just cook for everyone, and everyone's like, blah, you're just, but it's a constant, I constantly feed myself and numb myself. It's a constant, I just keep eating as I go along, I graze, but it keeps every emotion, every feeling, everything that'll hear. And if I go too long, then everything starts to get big, my head starts to get big, but I constantly numb myself throughout the day. So when you say to stop doing that, how do I stop that without it being a diet? What is the...
Work the steps. Begin at that moment working the steps. And you will begin to have a spiritual awakening. And that's where people fall down. It's the dieters leading the dieters. It's the blind leading the blind. If you have a sponsor that will take you through the big book and begin working the steps, you will be pointed in another direction. If you have a sponsor that's going to read to you out of the OA garbage, if you have a sponsor that's going to just read the meditation, or you're going to call your sponsor and you're going to say, my husband did this or my son did that or whatever that is, well, they're sick too, let's pray for them. Without getting to the causes and conditions that we're going to talk about this afternoon, we're going to examine this afternoon, where does anger come from? Where does fear come from? Where do these feelings of being unsettled come from, and what do we do with them now? So if you have a sponsor that is going to look at your part, not the other person, not, oh, well, you know, yes, he may have raped the dog, but let's just pray for him. That's not going to keep you out of the food. That's a diet. Let's look at the tomato paste you're using. No, that's a diet. But the bottom line is that if you are then going to work the steps, you will begin to have a spiritual awakening. When you walk to God, He will run to you. He's waiting there to ambush you with love. He is waiting there to open vistas in your life that we can't even conceive of at this point. I guarantee you, when I was in that hospital in 1983, no one would have suggested to me that in 2012, I'll come to Anchorage, Alaska, and be the speaker at an Overeaters Anonymous retreat. Probably not something that was discussed at that point, but here I am. Mm-hmm. Here I am. Nobody would have thought to tell, when they were telling my mother, you know, Virginia, he'll be dead by the time he's 30. Oh! You know, Max, he's going to be dead by the time he's 30. I'm 58. I might drop dead tonight. I don't know. But I'm 58. And I'm alive. Does that make sense? Work the steps. Yes.
Alex, compulsive over here.
Hi, Alex.
And one thought that I had when you were talking about, like, fighting battles that don't exist, I wanted to also, I was thinking, like, we don't just mentally fight ourselves, we do fight ourselves physically.
Sure.
And I think it's very easy to, like, be like, oh no, and we're calming the mind. Yeah, no, what we're doing essentially is fighting a war with our body. Like, we're having the mind on one side and one of the, like, the way I see it is like higher power on one side and disease on the other. And we're listening, if we're in the disease, we're listening to the disease side. And we're fighting the parts that we don't like, our defects, our life that is out of control with it. And that's how we fight a battle. And if you believe it, then it's very, very obvious that you're fighting it. And but even if you're just looking at the overeating part, which I had long before I had the bulimia, we are fighting our bodies. Because if you were to feed others the way you would feed yourself when you're in your binges, that's what they do to geese before Christmas. Like that force feed, the tube, and then the pouring the food in to get them as fat as they can, as possibly. So then there's more to slaughter around the holidays. So it's just kind of, you wouldn't do that. That is a war you're fighting. And if we are without a higher power and without doing the steps, we're not even fighting a losing battle. We're like signing up to like surrender immediately as soon as we pick up that food. So, yeah. And the other question I had was, you mentioned the first OA meeting on 19th of January, but what was the year?
1960. January 19th, 1960 is when we were started, and that's why every year in Los Angeles, the OA birthday will coincide by that date every year. And Roseanne is still around. I actually was at the OA birthday last year. I try to go every year. But I was there last year, and there were a few of us who went and saw her. And, you know, she's in her 80s. She's not 20 years old anymore. But what she did will live forever. She will never die. And she's alive and well in 60 countries with meetings all over this world. And what she did will live eternally in this world. She was one of those people who came in and left the world a much better place. And Overeaters Anonymous and AA came into the world with a lot of controversy. Oh my God, the fighting and everything was unbelievable. Yes?
Have you told your spiritual awakening story, your personal story yet, about your awakening?
If I didn't, I can only say this, and we're going to cover a lot of this in step two, but my spiritual awakening was of the gradual variety. God came to me very slowly. And for me, I had to really be out of ideas. And Tom, my sponsor, really, really came and said to me, you've got to be out of ideas. I was at a meeting in Swedish Covenant Hospital in Chicago in OA, and there was a speaker there, and she is my dear friend, and we talk every single day. We email back and forth every single day. But this is one of the things that happened to me. I saw life as being over there somewhere. And there were people, and they were running, and they were playing, and they were having a good time. And then there was a chasm over here, and I was over here on a little island by myself. And they kept beckoning to me that I should come join them, come join them. And I didn't know how to get over there, and I felt afraid of them. I wanted to be one of them, but I was scared of them. I was scared of the girls. I was scared of what they were doing. I was scared to be alone, or excuse me, I was scared not to be alone here on my island with all my food. And I went on a Thursday night to a speaker meeting at Swedish Covenant Hospital when nothing in Overeaters Anonymous made any sense to me. I didn't understand why they talked about God. I didn't understand anything. And Della F. was the speaker at the meeting. What did I have in common with Della? Nothing. She was a Roman Catholic housewife with a 5-year-old then and a 3-year-old then. They both have children of their own. They're grown. They're big. Della now has several grandchildren. And Della had a house and I lived in an apartment, and Della was married. I had at that point never been on a date with a girl in my life, and Della seemed to be rich and I was poor, and she was female and I was male. And she spoke that night at Swedish Covenants, and she talked about food and talked about how she thought about food and how she feared being detected eating and spending money on food in a way that I believed was secret unto me. I believed that I was the only human being that thought like that. I believed I was the only human being who did those things. And a rope was thrown between my island and their playing on the beach across the cavern. And my ego and my neurosis were lowered a bit, not through information, but through identification. Ego kept me away from accepting what God was and what the fellowship was offering. And I learned that ego is a conscious separation from the group. It's not just ease God out. Ego means I cannot be part of the group. I knew how to be better than you. I knew how to be worse than you. I knew how to look down on you. I knew how to look up to you, but I never knew how to look at you. Della opened up through, not through information, but through identification, that I could be one of many. Now, the position that I have today in OA is not one I sought after. I am another bozo on the bus. I'm either the best or the worst in my illness, but now I'm just another bozo on the bus. And other people started speaking, and I started listening to their stories, not so that I could make fun of them and judge them and make sarcastic comments about them in my mind, but so that I could open my mind and be willing to listen to what they said. And what they did was they presented human experiences that I was having and how they stayed out of the food and did so happily. The miracle of God for me is not that I have 13 years of abstinence. The miracle is not that I have not eaten in that time, but that I don't want to. And God came into my life in a way that was truly miraculous. My story is not a story of tremendous upheaval. My story is a story that I was carried across caverns in spite of myself. That I am alive today. Yes, I'm divorced. No, I didn't want to be. Yes, I am single. Yes, I don't have the great big house and the great big backyard anymore. No, I don't have the dog door to let my dog out. No, my daughter didn't speak to me for a year and a half. No matter how evolved my recovery, I will never rise above the level of a human being. But I have a place to go with my anger, with my fear, my selfishness, self-seeking, and dishonesty. I have step 10. I have all the steps, so that I can work that step constantly. I can work that step and hold God's hand and say, I'm scared. I'm afraid. I'm weak. Will you take me through today? And we're going to talk about step 11. And we're going to be talking about these various things, not just this afternoon, but a lot of it's going to be tomorrow morning. And I had to stop shouting at God about how big my problems are, and I had to start shouting at my problems about how big my God is. And yes, my business has fallen off a cliff. I am making 20% of what I was making. I've yanked money out of a SEP fund that I promised I'd never touch. I am making I used to pay more in federal income tax than I made the last 2-3 years. I used to pay more money in taxes than I now make. But I'm not the only person in that position. There's a lot of people that are not paying any tax because they're making nothing. I'm living in a rented apartment. Ugh, I've got a roof over my head. I've got a place that my rent is paid for June. My car payment is made. I have a way of getting around. I still got one dog left, and she's great. She's my little snuggle bunny. She's Emma. She's 7 years old. She's a pure-blooded German Shepherd, and I got news for you. She is so damn smart. And what a good dog. Oh, my God in heaven. We walk and we go in the morning, and she's my little love bug. She really is. And you know what? I come home, and my wife's not there, and my kid is not there. I don't have kids. I have a kid. She's not there, and so on and so forth. But Emma's there to greet me. Hell, I wish everybody was that glad to see me. Holy mackerel. And every day I pray the prayer, please, God, let me be half the man she thinks I am. I mean, my God in heaven. But I have a God, and that to me is a changing relationship. And I had to stop dragging that hippopotamus out through the dog door of a God that didn't work. I had to stop defining God in a way that never worked. I have a God that does work, because the job description of God is up to me. The work of God is up to Him. But I have a God that loves me. I have a God that takes care of me. I have a God that protects me from myself. My worst enemy is the same guy I look at in the mirror. Nobody ever did the damage to me that I've done, and He protects me. And I ask Him all the time, help me say the right thing to my child. You can't say anything. You have to text it. There's no talking anymore. Let me figure out what the hell that means. Or let me... I know I'm kind of getting that she wants a new laptop, but I don't know what the other stuff is, and I'm not getting her a laptop, and I'm not doing all this, and no, I'm not paying for this, this, and this. You know, I'm not doing it. I'm just not... At least, you know, I'm not doing it now. But, you know, and that's kids. You know, that's 17-year-olds. It's all about, yeah, I didn't talk to you for a year and a half, but will you buy me a laptop? That's kids. So does that make sense? And that was stuff I was going to cover later, but I'm covering it now. Because that's how I have a God in my life. It is not going to work for me to have a God that I don't trust. Why would I turn my will and my life over to a God that I didn't like or trust? The truth is, I'm not going to. And if some of you have been struggling, more often than not, if I was your sponsor and you're struggling with step 9, you're not struggling with step 9. You're struggling with step 2. Because you would go make those amends, because if you had a God you did trust, you hold God's hand, you go forth, you make your amends. Why would you give up the food? Why would you let go of a resentment? Why would you let go of a fear if you haven't worked step 2? One of the most misunderstood steps is 2. And if you're struggling with 9, or you've got somebody in your life, or you are struggling with 4, it's really not 4 you're struggling with, it's 2. But when you have that God in your life that you trust, that you love, and you feel that hand of God, you feel that Creator guiding you through your daily activities, then you're going to willingly and enthusiastically want to turn these things over to the care and direction of God. You're going to hear people BSing. I turned this over to God 10 years ago. No, you didn't, or we wouldn't be having this conversation about it. Come on, get off of it. Turning over means action. We've got 3 minutes. Does that make sense about how I had my spiritual awakening? Does that make sense about my relationship with God? My relationship with God is not different than my relationship with you. I met you last night. And today we have a different relationship. By tomorrow we'll have a different relationship. If some of you come to the OA birthday and I see you there, and you know, we'll have a different relationship, because we will have known each other from here. And as the years go by and God is kind enough to allow me to cross your paths again, our relationships will deepen and enrich, and they will be better and better as time goes on. And that's my relationship with God. The God I had in my heart and in my head 8 years ago, 10 years ago, is very different than the God I hold in my heart and in my head today. But I had to strip God down of the things about him that didn't work. He didn't get me a Playboy bunny. I couldn't go to the prom. I didn't go to the homecoming. I didn't, you know, all this other stuff. It's done. It's over. I gave this illness decades of my life. I'm not giving the son of a bitch food one more second. Not another second. I'm going to live until I die. And I can't do that without steps, and I'm not going to work steps if I don't believe in God. Thank you for the applause. Oh, that was a mosquito. Okay. We've got time for one quick one, and then we got to go to lunch, or we're going to have trouble here. Yes.
Is there anything you can think that sponsors can do for their sponsees if they think they got the God part covered, but you can see that they're not, and you're trying to walk them through the big book, and they're like, yeah, but I believe in God because I always believed in God, and it's... Is there anything sponsors can do?
Three things.
Okay.
Recover. Recover. And recover. Work the steps. They will find God when they want to.
Yep.
You can't make them want to. And if you're working the steps with somebody who has a religious training beyond yours, remind them that if your way worked, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Recover, recover, and recover. We've got time for one more from somebody who hasn't asked one yet. If we have, yes.
This is, you can't answer this in one minute, but I would really like at some point during this, and maybe you're going to, I'd like to hear why you think more men don't come to OA.
I have no answer for that. I get asked that almost every single place I go.
I
haven't got the slightest idea why.
Okay.
This is a very serious illness. It affects men as well as women, and I don't know. But here is what I also can tell you. In different locations in the country, these retreats and meetings are about half men, half women. Most of the meetings I go to in Scottsdale are a minimum of 40% men. What I see here is three guys, right? Randy and
Tim? We have another one that's not here,
including you.
Okay, three including me. If he's not here, then I obviously I can't count him, but you know. But the bottom line is I see two out of approximately 30.
Uh-huh.
In other areas of the country, that relationship of men to women will change, especially in Los Angeles or Phoenix or, you know, but I went to Billings, Montana 2 months ago and did one of these. And when I was in Billings, Montana, I don't know that there were any men there. Oh, there was one man there. Yeah, one man besides me. That was it. And I've done them where it was all women and me. And then the alarm clock went off. I've done them where it was all women or like one guy and me.